Hey, I'm just letting you know that in February 2023, I am speaking at my friend Andy Storch's event in Sonoma, California. It's called the Talent Development Think Tank. I'll be running a session on marketing your workshops. And on day three, I'll be hosting the 2-hour workshop blueprint session. I'd love to see you there. Head on over to leannehughes.com/thinktank. Enjoy the episode. Coming up next on Leanne Hughes's Work and Live Large.
And I thought I was Harvey Specter. I thought I could get them in, psychoanalyze them, crunch them, and figure out whether they're going to be good or not. And then what happens is time goes on and you realize that my predictive value here is zero. Like, this is terrible. And the other thing I realize is that I think a lot of businesses do the equivalent of a Tinder hire. They're desperate. They need something. They say, you seem normal and okay. Hey, do you want a job? But you think how much time you spent together and the consequences of getting it wrong, and then how little effort and time we put into that process.
Life's too short. You're here to work and live large. Here's your host with nothing to lose, Leanne Hughes.
Oh gosh, I'm so excited to bring this conversation to you. I'm your host and business consultant, Leanne Hughes. You're here because you know that life is too short to play mediocre, and you're up for some ideas on ways to bust out of any limiting beliefs. And actually, that is why I'm pumped about sharing today's conversation with you. My guest today is Matthew Stewart. And you know those friends that you've had for some time and you sort of stay disconnected on social media? Well, Matt and I have been friends since 2008. A big shout out to Lucinda and John Kay, our mutual friends. But every now and then, I'll jump onto Facebook or Instagram. I'll get a glimpse into what Matt is up to, and you see some really cool things. Things like mountain biking across Nepal, doing the Kokoda track in Papua New Guinea, running New York City marathons, and getting up to some serious stunts adventure in northern Queensland. Matt is uniquely qualified as both a chiropractor and physiotherapist, and he's the CEO of The Custodian Way, which owns a group of companies that all share one common mission, which is to create a global movement and deliver 30 million impact moments every year by the year 2030. Matt and I caught up a few years ago and just spoke about our mutual love for business and podcasting. And he was telling me all about his business and the incredible non-traditional ways of doing things, of not feeling constraints on what's been dished out in management textbooks, but completely reimagining, reshaping what work can look like, from the recruitment process to remuneration. The ideas that Matt shares here are amazing. And look, I've got to say, it's really nice to have friends that you look up to. And sometimes when I look at Matt's life and what he does, I think, how the heck does he do all these things? And I want to share a quick story on that. I didn't share this with Matt in the interview. I only remembered it recently. But we were at this We Are podcast event back in 2018. And there was a really, there was a podcast speakers function on that Friday night. And I said to Matt, oh, are you coming along to the function? And he says, oh no, it's date night. And that was a commitment that Matt had made to his wife, Nicola, for every Friday night. And I love that as an example, because what it just shows is that living to our values isn't something that you wait for. If you're intentional about what your values are, you can reinforce them every day through decisions like this. And living your values by allocating time to it, by blocking it in and committing. In this conversation, you'll hear us talk about what work and live large actually means to Matt. He'll share these non-traditional ways of working, how to dream big and cast away any type of constraint, as well as the importance of language and definitions and how you can stop buying in to social constructs. I dare say you'll listen to this conversation more than once. I think you'll get lots of ideas as you listen in to his pragmatic approaches. You can contact Matt Stewart at his website, which is matthewstewart.co. His company, The Custodian Way, also owns the following brands: Peak Sport and Spine Center, Employee Health Australia and New Zealand, and Experience Not Felt Possible. Matt also sits on the board of the 4ASD Kids charity. A link to all of these websites and Matt's contact details are in the show notes for this one over at podcast.leannehughes.com. I hope you love this one. Reach out to both of us. Let us know what you most enjoyed and what you learnt. Now onto the show. Matt, it's so great to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming to West Brisbane today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it's so good to actually see you in person.
Yeah, I know. It's been a long time. I think the last time we caught up was at a podcasting festival, which is kind of ironic that we're here now.
Yeah.
So tell me, the name of this show is Work and Live Large. What does that mean to you?
Well, I guess one of the things for me personally when starting out a business is that I wanted to design my life around work-life integration. Now, that means a lot of different things to different people. To me, it doesn't mean that you're working all the time. It means that the things that you need as a person that you've identified, you get through work. So for me personally, I really want meaningful relationships in my life. So through work, we deliberately design our work and the way we do things to cultivate that. I mean, some businesses don't care about it, but I do. And the other thing is that anything I'm passionate about, I create that playground that we can pursue that for a purpose that's, you know, bigger than the actual thing. I'm qualified as a chiro and physio, but, you know, what is it that I want to use that for? So for me, working and living large is creating a playground where you can pursue a purpose or something bigger than yourself. And at the same time, the things that you need as a person are integrated into that as well. I mean, this idea of working 9 to 5 and then start living outside that, it's just a poor use of time at the end of the day, because we've got to put so much time into work that there's enough time at work where you're not enjoying the things you got to do. So you got to make sure that you're extrapolating the things you do need as a person in that work.
I love the phrase playground. I want to pick up on that, because I think you mentioned that to me before and I just, my eyes was like, oh my gosh, what does that mean? And I think what you've just defined there is that the playground is different for different people. I think you and I have maybe a different playground, because you go to places and you mountain bike up crazy mountains. Can you let's talk about some of those experiences that you create. What does that look like for you? They're pretty extreme.
Yeah, so a lot of people will see me taking groups to, say, Nepal mountain biking or going to Kokoda, but really it's just a vehicle at the end of the day. So it's not about the extreme nature. And while it looks extreme, there's a lot of people who have come on these that you wouldn't define as extreme. We call it an experience not felt possible. And an experience not felt possible is really a vehicle to add a page to your book of life, which is what I'm passionate about. So first of all, you got to dream big and think without constraint. And then ultimately, you need a vehicle to attain things. So when we design an experience, it's not just a trip, but has things like meaning in it. It has to have some sort of purpose for you. We want people to acquire a new skill or overcome some sort of adversity. There's got to be an element of giving to it. It can't be just all about you. There's got to be a new setting that shows that the brain will really remember something if there's a new setting. And there's got to be an element of sacrifice. So if you think of a lot of things that you remember, there's always some sort of sacrifice or some sort of adversity that you need to overcome. And a lot of this was designed and thought about out of the research where you look at the remembering self versus the experiential self. And we now know that things that just are enjoyable in the moment aren't things that you necessarily remember in the future. So I wanted to add a page to the people's book of life, something when they're, 30, 40 years down the track, is something they remember. And when they think about it, they're proud of themselves. They get a sense of pride. The story that they tell about themselves and what they've done in their life is different, because that then informs for them what they're going to do in the future. So we don't just take trips. We take people who have an experience they don't feel possible. And really that word not felt possible really defines it, because what feels possible for each person is different. And what you feel is possible for you or not possible is different to somebody else. So what everyone gets out of it is different, because what everyone feels is possible or not possible is different. So one person may feel like going on that trip is not possible because they'll never get it across the line with their partner. Another person might not feel it's possible thinking they'll never get the time off work. Another person might not feel that that trip is possible because of their fitness, or I'm not that sort of person. So that's what it's all about. While it looks all extreme, ultimately we're taking people on a journey to have an experience not felt possible, add a page to their book of life.
It's funny, because when I was looking at that website for Nepal, you're right, the thing that was going through my mind was I could never do that. And so it sounds like maybe I'm the perfect candidate for it, because that's exactly what I'm thinking as I see those images. You talk about dreaming big, and I think, was it your physio that had those letters outside the front, in the front yard, the words dream big?
Yeah, so one of our clinics or arenas, as we like to call them, has the big, as you think Melbourne or LAX, we've got the big letters out the front, dream big. And, dream big means something to everyone, but what it doesn't mean to us is necessarily doing something big or something that other people would define as being big. For us, dreaming big is literally just thinking without constraint. So first of all, starting before you think of all the reasons you can't do something, is thinking without constraint. And that's really important to do so. And to dream big takes courage, because you've got to think about an ideal state that might not feel possible, right? So And what those barriers are for each person are different. So dreaming big is just really the first start of, like, if you're going to bake a cake, it's like, what's step one? Right, you need to dream big. And that is get into a mindset where you're not going to put up constraints as you're working through this. And there's a couple of reasons for that, is that these different constraints are different guardrails that we have in our life, and you're sort of constrained by that. Second of all, things may be possible. You just might not be able to see how to do it. And just because you can't think of it doesn't mean that it's not possible. And it's really funny that when you actually define your ideal state and you've got the courage to share it with other people, how people want to come and actually help get you there, that's really humbling, and it actually brings out the best in people. And so it's a really beautiful thing when you see someone getting vulnerable and saying, I don't know how I'm going to do this. This is really uncomfortable for me, but this is my dream and this is what I want to do. And not being worried about tall poppy syndrome or getting cut down or people saying you can't do it, you actually see it brings out the best of people around you. And you just notice if someone puts a problem in front of you, how we're just wired to help solve problems. And you'll be amazed at how many people around you then want to help get you there. So when we talk about dreaming big, it's relative to the individual, and it shouldn't be thought of as something necessarily big, like, you know, going up Everest or doing a New York marathon. And there's someone who, you know, sticks in my mind as a perfect example. This guy came to one of our arenas and he had a social phobia. And, you know, for him even to come to the waiting room was a big issue. And for him to even think about going out and doing one lap around an oval out in public was like literally the most terrifying thing he could possibly think of. So for him to set that as something he wants to achieve is dreaming big. It doesn't feel possible. But when you put the right people around you, it can become possible. And there's one story, I guess, that's really dear to my heart that was really important to me that solidified what dreaming big was about. And there was a lady that came in. She was about 80 and she sort of waddled on in. This is when I was still clinical. And I thought, oh, he's a lovely old lady, I can see. And turns out she's one of the grumpiest people I ever met. She was so narky. She'd been said to me by the one of the doctors, and I had some knee osteoarthritis, and all that they wanted her to do is be able to get up 7 steps. And that was her house. It was an old Queenslander. So I got her, and she just wanted to be able to get up those stairs, and that's it. And in the treatment, she wasn't really giving me too much. It was a bit of a hard one to crack. On about the 4th or 5th visit, I said to her, even though you can't, if you could, what is it that you'd love to be able to do? And in that moment, everything shifted, and I'll never forget her eyes. They sort of locked on me, and her eyes just dilated. And she said to me, Matt, my husband and I met, and when we went on our first date, we went up the clock tower in Brisbane. Now, at that time, the clock tower was one of the tallest. We used to be able to go up there. And we promised each other on our 50th wedding anniversary that we would go up to the clock towers, but I can't do it because of how many stairs there are. I said, okay, Carol, well, even though you can't, you know, what if we could? And I said, look, let's not say anything to your husband and let's work on that. And long story short, we worked it. I called them. I figured out how many stairs there were to the top of the clock tower, and we got her there. And I still get goosebumps, telling that story. So for the rest of her life, there's a page in her book of life that wouldn't have been there because of the constraints she put on herself. And dreaming big isn't going and doing something crazy. It's like, what is it that you'd love to be able to do in your life, but you're putting some constraints? Now, that's not to minimize that some people do have constraints in their life, okay, and discount that, because I do understand that. But if you don't put it out there and you start to work through that and share it with the people around you, you won't know what is possible. So this particular lady, my favorite story, and that was just like a huge moment where I was like, that's actually what it's about, right? That here's an 80-year-old lady able to do something that she never felt possible, and she'll remember this for the rest of her life. Not only that, her story now of her life forever is different. She can now say, I did that. And when she sits with her grandchildren, she can share that story, right? All from that one question, right? And then trust me to help take her through that process. So if not for asking that question, then her trusting me to take her through that process for something that she still didn't believe could happen, she wouldn't be able to sit here today and tell that story. So for me, that story there really tells me what the possibility of dreaming big is all about.
Yeah, beautiful story and such a powerful question as well. I mean, there's a few things that sort of come to my mind when I hear that. And this show is about living large. And so I'm exactly with you, aligned on let's encourage people to do that and take those risks and actually have the confidence, even as you talk about courage, to even think about it. Now, I was joking about the podcast studio. It's actually in my home here. But sometimes I'll go out onto the balcony and you've got blue skies, and I try to encourage like blue sky thinking and just like limitless. You know, when you're inside, it's hard to do that. When you're outside, you think of possibilities. And I was trying to imagine, you know, what I want in 5, 10 years. And we're both follow Don Miller. And he's like, talk, you know, write your obituary. And as I was writing it and thinking about it, I was like, am I playing too small here? Or is this too big? Is this a joke? And it's funny because I'm all about this way of thinking, yet I'm still one to start critiquing it before I even tell anyone, or even don't feel brave enough to write those dreams down on a page. How do we just get past that? Do we just like write it down and tell someone? Like, how do we stop the constraints from like constantly just filling our brains?
Well, I don't think they ever go.
Yeah, damn.
And we have a negativity bias as humans, right? So first of all, it's not to feel shame or embarrassment for having those doubts. Like, we all have them. And I can guarantee the people you think don't have them, that you look at and think they're like so confident, got this, they probably have them more than anyone else. And that's a part of the things that they're driven by. But it really comes down to this whole idea of you need to surround yourself with people that give you the safety to pursue these things and encourage them. So whether it be the business you're in, not being supportive of those hopes, dreams, and aspirations, or friends or family, you need to collide often enough with people who are going to support that. And that keeps you on track, because you need accountability. All the research shows you everyone needs accountability, but you need to be able to put it out there. And some people won't put it out there because then you are accountable to a degree, yeah, that's it. Right? Yeah. You have to follow through because people will ask you about it. But that's helpful. Also, think in terms of the dreaming big, you do need some form of constraints to arrive at the direction you want to go in. So, for example, you know, a lot of people, you know, Simon Sinek talks about, you know, what's your why? And people who haven't read his stuff would sit there and they get a lot of panic. Like, what's my why? What's my, I don't know what my why is. How do I think about my why? Everyone's got a why. I don't know what my why is, right?
My why isn't good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In our business, we use a decision-making framework to make a lot of decisions. It's not new, but it serves us well. So every decision we make, we consult our values. So it can't violate our values. We ask, how's this going to impact our team or our tribe, as we call them, our business and the individual? And every decision needs to be good for all three layers, because if it's not good for one of those layers at some point, it will break down and it won't be sustainable. Then the decision has to move us closer to our vision and mission. And we look at, well, what data is there to support this decision? And data isn't always just numbers. It could be, you know, qualitative or quantitative, whichever way you want to look at it, but you're looking for some evidence. And is it scalable and reproducible? Within that, we have freedom within limits, right? So anyone can make a decision, but you're expected to be able to explain your decision within the framework of the decision-making framework. So you've got complete freedom. We celebrate mistakes. As
really?
Gary Ridge would say, that they're learning moments,
yeah.
Right? So you don't get in trouble for making a mistake or the outcome. You won't be looked favorably for not having thought through the decision-making framework, right? Well, have you thought about how this impacts the broader tribe, or have you just, you know, thought about yourself, or have you thought about the impact of the business and so forth? So in the same way, in terms of thinking about what your 10-year plan is, I think you do need some constraints to help get the brain to focus on a way forward. Otherwise, a complete blank canvas is just like looking at a cursor that's just like blinking at you and you're like, I don't know where to start. So some of the things you can start with is like, well, what are my values? Okay, I'm not prepared to do anything that violates these. So go for it. I can dream big and pursue anything, but I'm not going to violate these values, right? What isn't, you know, in a business, it might be a vision or mission, but in your personal life, it may be like, well, what is the overall arching direction of my life that I want to take, right? Now, I think when you're younger, they're very much things like, I want to get a degree, or I want to do these things. As I've got older and I go through this process every year, that mountain metaphorically I want to move towards is things like, you know, quality relationships, serving a purpose, etc. You know, they're not necessarily tangible things, right? So then you ask, well, what's going to serve those things? And then you might have some other constraints in your life to work within. But once you've got those, then you've got the playground and you can go for it. And you can do anything you like within that and surround yourself with the people who can support it and then go for it, right? But like walking through a forest, you have your map and you have your plan. You get start and you got your finish destination. in the jungle of life, you're going to come across obstacles. And also, as you take the first or second step, you may be in a better position to slightly change course once you've gone some way into the jungle, because you can actually see what's in front of you. And you know what it feels like. It's like, well, yeah, I thought I could walk 30 kilometers with a 20 kilo pack, but now that I've done it and I have the felt experience, actually, I'm stronger than that. I can go further. So I'm going to miss that camp and go to the next one, right? But what isn't changing is your starting point, the things you're not willing to violate, and your overall end point, you know, where you're trying to get to. And then feel free to change your mind within that jungle that you go on, but just know you just got to get into the jungle to start learning as well. And you can never map out step 1 to 10 perfectly. And if you do and you don't change it at all, you probably haven't taken notice of some of the valuable information you've learned on that journey.
That sort of reminds me of that quote from poet David Wyatt. I don't know if you've heard it. He says, that which you can plan is too small for you to live. Because when you were talking about the jungle, I thought, oh, you know, the backpack's too heavy, you're going to have to retreat home. But you're like, no, you could, you took the positive spin on that, which I love in that example that you provided. Yeah. The other thing in terms of values, I found a really useful exercise, because there often is when we're in the jungle, we get distracted by all the things that we're capable of doing, but don't necessarily light us up or give us joy.
Yeah.
It's like the Michael Bungay Sr. talks about good work and then the great work. And how that, yeah, the good work we do is like the enemy of getting to the great work. So a good example of the values is define yourself at what, in terms of what you're aspiring to, but also what you're not and the subtle difference between the two. So something I talk about, one of my personal things is I know I'm in a good space when I'm fully charged, like when I have that momentum, versus when I'm on charge, where I've got power, but it's not necessarily in a forward moving motion. So just like it's a subtle distinction, but it helps me, just reminds myself of, is this the right opportunity that I'm accepting? And sometimes we have that sort of feel, that gnawing feeling. So, I mean, how long have you been in business now?
This is our 10-year anniversary.
Wow, congrats.
Yeah, thank you.
A whole decade. And what's really shifted like over that time in terms of like your experience? When you talk about now that your aspirations are a bit more higher level as opposed to the tactile, what was it like in the first couple of years compared to year 10?
Oh, man, so much has changed. Okay. But to your point about what you're not, I mean, as the Dalai Lama says, you know, things are either about fear or love, right? So are you making this decision out of fear, or are you making it out of love and, you know, in terms of love of moving towards what you want? And that's a really important distinguishing factor. There's so many lessons in the last 10 years. But I guess probably the first one and the biggest one was the realization about 2 years in about how many blind spots you have. That, you know, so confident going in and having no right to be confident. Done 2 degrees, a physio and a chiro degree, 7 years of uni there, a lot of clinical practice, and then opened and started a business and thought I knew it all, right? And it wasn't until I was about 18 months in that I was like, holy shit, I have no idea what I'm doing. And there's tangible consequences. Like, the world doesn't care about you and it doesn't care how you feel. But it will throw the outcome in your face, right? So when you collide with the world, that'll happen. So that was the first thing. I was like, I have so many blind spots, and blind spots that I don't even know about. That's why they're called blind spots. So that was a really important but also a very painful part of a journey, because you know, there was a lot of things that weren't going so well as a result of that. And then I had to go find other people. So that was a really important lesson to know, to find people to give you that 360 view around you. So that was really important. Another way like it manifested is in terms of recruitment. So we now have a 5-stage recruitment process where it's an opt-out. So we don't tell people they can't come and play with us. They basically opt out of the process.
Oh, tell us about the process.
Yeah. So where it came from is that, you know, when I started in the business, I'd interview people and interview them once, and I thought I was Harvey Specter. I thought I could get them in, psychoanalyze them, crunch them, and figure out whether they're going to be good or not. And then what happens is time goes on and you realize that my predictive value here is zero. Like, this is terrible, right? And the other thing I realized is that I think a lot of businesses do the equivalent of a Tinder hire. They're desperate. They need something. They say, you seem normal and okay. Hey, do you want a job? But you think how much time you spend together and the consequences of getting it wrong, and then how little effort and time we put into that process. So first, I needed a thought experiment of how I was going to think about this, right? So there's a couple of things. One, we have a value, which is choose your pain. So regardless of how much pain we're in, know that getting the wrong person in is going to be a lot more painful across the journey, right? So put up with any short-term heat, right? No matter how bad it is, don't take the wrong person. So then the thought experiment I came up with was hire for life. How would I design a recruitment process if I was to hire someone for life? Now, nothing is forever and it's not literal, but as a thought experiment, if I treat the process like that, surely this is going to increase the probability. So a couple of things of that. First of all, we treat the person coming to our business as the expert. Like, it's crazy. Maybe they might know inside whether they like this or not. So our job is to break into five phases to give them so much information that at each stage, they're either like, hell yes, I'm a good fit, or you guys are really great and I really love your business and you're so passionate, but it's not me. And it's not just about the vision, right? Because the reality is in a workplace, there's other mechanics like work hours, how you get remunerated, bonus schemes. Like, there is a lot of hygiene things as well, right? Where someone could be like, I love that vision, I'd love to serve it, but the other mechanics don't work for me. So our first part of the process, and I'll give you the short version, is largely just a screening hygiene type part. Then our stage two is a really 1 to 2 hour stage two recruitment where we're providing a lot of information about the role. And what we actually do is deliberately try to give people things that typically someone would resign over, right? So the way I think about it is, how do you remove future landmines, right? You know the sorts of things that will cause people to resign in the future. Let's give it to them up front and try find reasons for that person not to say, I want to go to the third stage, right? So we give them, it's like, whoa, have you thought about this? Like, it could be really bad getting up at 5 o'clock every morning and you're doing this. And they're like, you know, you're not doing a great job at selling this. But if they hear all this and they're still like, no, I still want to go forward, right? The other thing is, we often think things are a negative, but it's like beauty's in the eye of the beholder. What we think is a negative in another person's eyes could be a positive. So we go through that. Then the next phase is what we call a day in the life. So they come in and they do a full day from start to finish in our business. And most people in our process don't go through. So this has happened quite a lot. And it's a big overhead for the business to constantly be facilitating people coming into your business and spending a full day. Because you can look at a website and you can look at LinkedIn, you can do all this stuff, but you need to see it, right? And we also want them to increase in their mind the certainty that they go, look, the things that are important to me, they're not just telling me, I'm seeing it and it's true. So do that. Then we go to a presentation stage. At the presentation stage, it has nothing to do with the actual presentation. It's a Trojan horse for getting them in front of our tribe. And at that point, it's both ways. Our tribe are there to ask them questions and this person's there to ask our tribe questions. I never attend, right? And then out of that, the person then decides whether they want to go to the last stage. But this is the only stage where we really have a say. And at that point, our tribe decide whether that person goes to the fifth stage. Yes, right. And it's a really beautiful thing because there's nothing better. This is one of my most favorite things of my job is when I get to call someone at the end and say, look, you're going to be really nervous, you know, starting next week. But one thing you don't need to worry about is us wanting you here. Because did you know, like, we need 90% of the tribe to say yes to you and all of the directors, right? So when you walk in day one, you know, at least 90% of people said, well, I actually want you as a part of my tribe. And all of the directors, you have to be worrying about who wanted me, who didn't want me. That person seems a bit standoffish. Do they like me? No, they did, right? You belong here. And then you say to the tribe, hey, this isn't HR pushing someone on you. You chose to have this person as a part of your tribe. So you bloody look after them, right? And this is not us saying that hiring this person, you as the tribe have hired this person into the tribe. So you look after them, you shape them, you teach them and so forth. Then the fifth stage is all the hygiene stuff like, you know, contracts and remunerate, which is just as important. So each stage is not weighted more or less important. Each stage is very important. And when you break that out and then you think how people just go from an interview and get offered a job, how can someone understand what a day in the life is, really understand their contract and so forth, understand and meet the tribe, understand all elements of your business off one single meeting? It's impossible. You cannot synthesize that amount of information. So the reality is most people don't go through the process. Most people opt out at some point, right, for varying different reasons, right? And it can feel like a loss to get, because we put a lot of effort into, say, get someone to the fourth stage. And sometimes then people opt out. So it can feel like, oh, you know, that's, you know, such a pain. But no, we celebrate it and go, how great to think if we had a normal recruitment process, that person would be in. How good that we just invested, say, an extra 5 to 8 hours and figured out now that we're not a good fit for each other. Because breakups are painful, right? What happens is people get in and then they go, look, you guys are nice. Your vision's amazing. I have inherently no problem with you, but it's just not a good fit for me, right? And then because of that, they go, oh, they stay 6 months too long when they really should have just break up there. And then it's bad for your business. It's bad for them. And it's bad for your consumer. It's bad for everyone, right? So you better figure it out then and there. Now, is any process bulletproof? No, it's not. But it's about degrees of probability, right? So when you're playing the long game and you genuinely care about the people in your business, you want to hire them for life and treat them that way in your business, that the first stage is the recruitment process. So that's one part of how we've designed our business to hire people for life. And at the end of the day, it comes down to then how to serve the vision. Because if you get that wrong with the people in your business, you can't best serve the vision and mission.
I'm so impressed with that. So did you create that strategy, the 5-step recruitment strategy?
Yeah. So
I love it.
Yeah. So it came with a concept, an idea. Someone who really helped shape that was Dylan Whistle, who's, worked in our business for a long time. And so it started with a thought experiment. And I said, look, hey, I'm thinking I'm Harvey Specter here, but I'm not. Here's the concept of thought experiment. Here's the sort of stages I'm thinking about. And then we sort of really refined it from there. But like any sustained continual improvement, you need to hone it, right?
Yes.
So we're still honing it. We'd still like to make it better. It's like that thirst you can't quench, right? It's like, how do we make this better?
Yeah.
Okay, it's working, let's say, 7 out of 10 times. How do we get that to 8, 9, 10 and so forth? So we've got more detail in there. There's a few other steps, but yeah, it's really good. And the thing I like about it, puts the power in the
That's what I love the most about it. That's the plus. It puts it on the team, like that they're going to be part of. That's what I love the best, like in terms of the autonomy on them making a decision, and then the accountability shifts. Yeah. Rather than like blaming HR or the leader for recruiting this person.
Yeah.
They were the collective that brought them in. Yeah. The Harvey Specter thing is hilarious. I was listening to a Malcolm Gladwell episode, Revisionist History.
Yeah.
And he talks about how we vote people into office.
Yes.
And he's looking at student council people and also presidents. They did this experiment where he actually basically said at the end of the whole episode that it would be more effective just to do a lottery, because our ability to predict whether someone will be fit for the job or good for the job, we can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think about, I was sort of taking that example to even when I go grocery shopping and I have to predict how many grocery bags will I need to take into the store. Mm. Like, oh, this is a 2-bag shop or a 3-bag shop. I always get it wrong. It's so hard to predict the future. Yeah. And so it sounds like a really robust process where you've got all these different touch points. I'm curious around, because you've got some really cool ideas. I think a while ago, correct me if I'm wrong, but you mentioned that you openly share remuneration. Is that still the case? Do you still do that? Yeah. Can you tell us like some of the X factor things you do in your business that aren't quite traditional?
Well, I guess we're really strong in our decision-making frameworks. We have our hire for life mentality. Yeah, we encourage people to dream big. So we do our vision board process every year in the business. This is actually the first year in the business I don't do it one-on-one with every person. I run the process one-on-one, not because I'm trying to position myself as some all-knowing life guru, but just because I'm passionate about the process. And what I do is I share concepts and frameworks to help make them think about long-term. I don't tell them what to do. So that's, really, really important part of our business. Look, everything's driven by our values and tribes. Our voting, like there's no status. So for example, at one of our arenas, there's a car park and it has director on it. And in all the other businesses, the pharmacy and doctors, all the directors and owners park in that. And I said, I don't deserve that. Like I shouldn't just get that, right? So every week we vote on who's demonstrated the values the most and they get the car park, right? One day I snuck in and I was running late and I parked in there, and within about 5 minutes I had about 6 people telling me that I'd parked into the car park. I wasn't the car park winner for that week, and that if I wanted to get the car park, I've got to step up my game a little bit more. So we do that. Look, there's other things around, for example, so for Hire for Life, we also don't performance manage people out in the business. So there's a couple of ways to do that that are important. So first of all, when we have a career conversation, often performance and money are tied together, right? So to make people feel safe that you can actually just have a conversation that's going to help improve them or get them closer to executing on our vision and mission, they need to feel safe around that, right? So everyone in our business knows that we don't performance manage people out, but that doesn't mean we don't have courageous conversations, and it's expected you have a courageous conversation, okay? The next thing that we do is people in our business decide their own bonus. So I mean by that, like if they have a, there's a way we calculate how much bonus that they get, they're eligible for, they rate themselves, and that rating, self-rating determines their bonus. Now we do rate them, right? But our rating has nothing to do with calculating their bonus, right? So that way they know we're not giving a rating because we're trying to penny pinch or something. We just want to have the conversation. So you take the bonus off the table, and we're more interested in having the conversation than we are trying to save any dollars, right? So there's a couple of things that we do very differently that we're very strong courageous conversations, and we call it if someone doesn't follow our playing to win behaviors, as we call them, we've got 10 of them. We call it a drop ball, that you call someone out in real time on that. But there's no performance management. So no one's ever been performance managed in our business for 10 years. And with courageous conversations and discussing honestly with people, either two things happen. People step up or they step off, right? But if they step off, there's no shame, right? There's a lot of shame attached with quitting, right? So for us, it's not a problem if people want to step off, and they know that. So there's a couple of things we do mechanically that really help shape your business, because people need to feel safe to be able to have these discussions with you as a business also, and know there's not consequences. The other thing is, we have our playing to win behaviors. So our playing to win behaviors are 10 behaviors that are expected by everyone in the business that anyone can perform of any skill set. So someone starting day one can execute on these behaviors, right? There's nothing to do with skill. And it's a standard modus operandi that's expected from everyone. It's one standard of behaviors expected from everyone. You can't always shape the outcome, but we can all have a set of acceptable behaviors amongst each other. And it removes interpretation, because if you say something like, be professional, right? To some person, that means
Wear a suit and tie.
Wear a suit and tie, right? Where another person's like, well, I'll wear my Birkies rather than my pluggers today, right? It's too open to interpretation. Yeah. So the behaviors are a common denominator. You take people from all different backgrounds, all different skill sets, different ages, and you give everyone a common operating code to be able to operate by. Because businesses are funny where you take people from all different backgrounds, and then you need them to collaboratively work together. So you need a common language, right? It's no different to go into another country and go, what's the language here? People can cooperate much quicker if you have a common language to operate by.
Can you give me an example of one of the behaviors?
Yeah. So these aren't revolutionary, but it's like the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. Perfect. Right?
Yes.
I'm committed to getting uncomfortable. Yeah. They're just, very, simple things like that. And they're not that difficult. But the funny thing is that as humans, we don't always like approaching a colleague to often call this out. And, we've tried to implement a flat management structure where basically the tribe rule rather than some hierarchy. Because what would typically happen is someone would notice something about someone, and then they'll go, oh, I'm going to go talk to my manager and they can deal with it. Well, we go, have you had a courageous conversation with Tom? No, well, I think that's going to be your thing for the week. You need to go talk to him about cleaning the gym. Okay, how did it go? So when you enter these, though, is our number one principle is you seek first to understand, then be understood, right? So these are not my principles. Other people have come up with these. But that just takes a charitable view, right? So we're not assigning meaning to the behavior. We're just noticing it, right? Some could say, hey, look, I noticed that you're 12 minutes late today. Right, and you weren't prepared for the meeting, is everything all right? That's not like you. So you're still raising it. And they say, look, I just found out, my nana's had a fall in her aged care facility, had to run and help her out. I'm really sorry. What can I do to help? Right. So we always take a charitable view of it, and we don't assign meaning to the behaviors, that they just are what they are. It's like pointing to the building and say that building is on fire. It's just a fact, right? We're not saying why or who did it or how it happened or even whose fault it is, right? We're just saying it as it is. And then it's like a muscle. There's certainly people who find this a lot easier than others. That is one downside of this system, and that is that people who do find this harder, it does take a little bit to get used to. However, what they find is when they're used to it and they see that there's no consequences socially within the business as a result of doing it, it opens up a flood of other things, yeah. You know, and then because otherwise what happens is resentment builds, you know, over time. It's like a little pebble in your shoe and you see that work colleague not doing that thing and not pulling their weight. You put up with it for a while, but then it builds up and resentment builds and then it manifests in other ways. So it's actually a really, I think, a really beautiful skill to teach people to go up to someone in a charitable way, seek first to understand, but talk to them about an agreed standard that you've had. And that's what it is. It's just like in marriage, this is an agreed standard that we have. So by coming to our business, you are signing up to being a custodian of our playing twin behaviors. And in doing that, that you will call people out and do it in real time, because there should be no surprises at career conversation time, ultimately. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're talking about people that have come to your business from other businesses where that is not the standard, where you are sort of a little bit scared of saying things, or the approach is to go to your manager and everything else. So I guess it might be like the onboarding process where they actually feel safe and recognize that this is okay. That's such a powerful thing. Now, when are you getting onto the TED stage and like sharing this with like this new way of working? I mean, we're noticing the whole great resignation is really about leaving poor cultures, poor environments where you don't feel like you can bring your talents and you don't feel safe. It's so time for this to be shared. So like, is it something that you want to like broaden out to the world, like your way of working? Like, what are you thinking?
I think it could be adopted more broadly in a lot of ways, but also the way we operate, I'm not saying is the best way. It is the best way based off our tribe and the way that we want to operate. So this goes back to the recruitment. So there are lots of great businesses out there and you need to find your tribe. And every different organization will have a different modus operandi. And what happens is you have an internal value system, and that way of that business operating will then sit on your value system and it'll feel right or it won't feel right. So the people that are in our business and love it, the way we operate directly resonates with their values and their worldview. Other people who have come and gone, it doesn't. And there have been people come and gone and they're like, they don't like it. And that's not to say we're right and they're wrong, right? We've just established a way of working and we have our reasons for that. And they need to go find a tribe that works differently, that aligns with them. But I do think in general, the ability to communicate and go up to someone and not feel frame it as confrontation, is really, really important. And I think the quality of your life will change when you can actually learn to do that, because what you actually realize, the story you're creating about the thing is probably, it's not as bad as you thought. How the person responds is usually 1,000 times better than you ever imagined in your mind. And it just lives rent-free in your head, all this stuff otherwise. Like, you just deal with it on the spot, right?
That's freedom, isn't it?
Yeah. And it just feels good, particularly when you're in a business and you're in each other's space. Let's say you're getting annoyed with someone. Every time you see them, it gets triggered off, right? And it builds up and it's not healthy. So it's just generally, just as a general principle, a good thing just to go to cultivate this skill ultimately. The end of the day.
It's so true. Like, I mean, that sort of links into personal brand as well. I've certainly working in corporate, I'd get an email from someone that maybe it was building up, and I'd even just see an email and like just rage would like wash over me, and all about just stamping it out in the moment. And sometimes even as a recovering people pleaser, I'll say yes to things in the moment and then I'll have to figure out like, oh, weeks later, how do I say no again? Whereas if I could just be comfortable as you talk about and just being psychological, just saying what you're feeling. I like the idea of living rent-free, like in your own mind, because I think there's just so much real estate going on in there.
Yeah. But you got to give people a methodology to interlock, okay? Mm. So rules of engagement that everyone operates by, because that way it's not personal. It's when people operate in different ways and approach it in different ways. So again, you need to have an agreed way that, hey, if there's something that's worrying me, or I see a drop ball, or we disagree on something, how do we do that? Because everyone will do it differently. And then that's when people get offended, because someone does it a different way, they assign meaning to it. So establishing a way to disagree and establishing a way to resolve things is also really important. Mm-hmm. But also just building that expectation in the business that you address things in real time. And real time doesn't necessarily mean literally like right now. But like, you know, the next few days or this week, you know, you need to address it, right? And it's really healthy for everyone at the end of the day.
The what I'm hearing from you is I really like, so you got drop ball, you got tribes, you got the arena. So, and you talk about meaning as well. It sounds like language is very important in your business. Have you really thought about the way that you communicate?
Yeah, it's funny you brought that up. So where this was born out of was the fact that I did my first degree as a chiropractor. I did my second degree as a physio. And what I learned going through both of those degrees is that often they were talking about the same thing, but in different words. but also how much words matter, like how much, you know, dogma and meaning is associated with words, right? So one of the epiphanies I had for myself, which has really changed the course of my life, when I was about 27, I'd finished both degrees. And, you know, growing up in a low socioeconomic area, dreaming about what it'd be like to have professional qualifications and working, I felt completely different to how I did, and not in a good way, right? And I'm like, what is the deal with that? So then I had to start reflecting on that. And the epiphany for me was that these professions are abstract concepts and ideas. They're not real. There is nothing such as a physio. There's nothing in the world such as a chiro. Gravity is real. Carbon's real. A physio and chiro are not real. These are abstract ideas, constructs of society that we get anchored to and ego attached to it. And then there's turf wars and all this stuff that goes along with it. And it stops you, it gets in the way of actually doing the bloody reason you got into it in the first place. So I was like, what did I even get into this for, right? Then it came, it's like, I just need to view these as tools, right? To help achieve the thing that I'm passionate about, and don't lose sight of that. So once I actually got clear on what I was passionate about and then reframed my professional qualifications as just a tool or lever to help get there, it completely changed. So then one of the things I want to do is a lot of professional health professionals say, you know, I'm all about helping people, but then sort of like in brackets, as long as it's my profession, my way, and you know, it's et cetera, right? Because there's an attachment to that. So what I learned is even if you want to get different health professionals to collaborate, had to remove some of the language that already was preloaded between the professions. And also want to change my relationship between what you typically call a patient, which we call athletes, and the health professional, right? Because I think even calling someone a patient is a very passive, unempowering relationship. So we call them an athlete. An athlete is someone who just has something they want to work towards. It's not that you're a literal physical athlete, but you're in control. You have your goal, and we're the coach. So everyone in our business is called a coach. We're there to stand beside you. We can't do it for you. We're not here to be better than you. We're just here to go, how do I help that person achieve their goals, right? So then if you've got athletes and coaches, we've got an arena. Even the clinic, to me, feels very sterile.
Very clinical.
And
like literal,
it's like, oh, I'm in a clinic. I'm a poor passive patient. I'm here to be told what to do. It's like it's not conducive to the mindset that will help people dream big and move forward. So everything we do from recruitment to language needs to align to the overall vision and mission. So you got to go, well, is this language helpful or hindering? Well, if it's hindering, we need some new language, right? So the other one, like in terms of a receptionist, is the worst bloody term. We call them all-stars because they literally every single person that comes through our business goes through their hands, right? And they have an amazing ability to shape people, to make an impact and take people on a journey. And calling them, you know, when I hear them, you know, in the past say, I'm just a receptionist, I'm like, oh, you do not understand how important you are to our business. So in our business, we said, well, you're going to be called an all-star, and an all-star doesn't get paid any less than what our coaches do who are qualified professionals, right? Because that's how important you are to our business. So language does matter, and particularly when a lot of language is rooted in history, it does change how people feel about themselves and then that interaction. So I think language does matter, and I think we need to probably go through a period of redefining language that's going to be more helpful to moving, I guess, the world in the direction we want
to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Even one of my old bosses, Wicked Campers, he's a real sort of entrepreneur, but he hated phrases like the war on drugs. Mm. He's like, it's not a battle against that. Like, you got to talk about like the positive, like what are we trying to free people from? And but even at a micro level for me with language, it was more about just reframing some workshops I was running. This is like 10 years ago. We had like an email, you know, email management 101. Like, who wants to go to that? Then you call it email hell to email heaven.
Yeah.
And the adoption just grows through the roof. And you think, okay, where else can I apply this? And I often find with clients, like they've got a problem with communication or strategy. It's like, what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
And it's through their definition that you can actually start addressing it, because they are just like social construct. Like, people have their own definition of what that looks like. So, I mean, that alone is just helpful enough.
Well, the beauty about using your own term or using a term in a non-traditional environment is that you get to define it for yourself and in your business. But when you take a term that's widely understood, people usually adopt the
legacy and
understanding and what the normal understanding of it is. So it gets very hard to shape that. So sometimes it's easy just to plug to a break new term. It, to yeah, break just it. Put a whole new different term in there. Yeah.
Well, it's even like the association with like people think presentation, I've got to open a PowerPoint. It's like, stop that, break it. Yeah. You know what I mean? And to do that, maybe just call it something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's such a fun way to think about and look at life. I've got a couple of rapid questions for you. What is a book that shaped the way that you think?
I think there's two that I'm going to share. So look, I think this is well read, but Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. I don't know if you've read, but it's unbelievable. I mean, that story is incredible. You talk about overcoming adversity, you know, persistence. You know, I think of like Shackleton when I think of him, like the persistence, you know, through the amount of headwinds and problems and issues. To be honest, I was never a fan of Nike and I never wore their stuff. And I read that book and I thought the next time I'd buy their shoes. It's a really powerful story. Yeah, of even how their brand represents, you know, more than you know, a shoe. But I definitely recommend that. And then look, the other one, which was really informative, was A Brief History of Western Philosophy by Bertrand Russell, which is probably one of the most well-known Western philosophy books. But it's well known that we bias our lifetime and what we've seen in our lifetime. And then when you start looking back at a little bit more of the span of history and all the different empires that have risen and gone, they're all saying the similar things. I guess that's wisdom. And trying not to having to make those mistakes to learn those lessons and learn from them. But so there's just a lot of common things that came out of that were really informative for me to try keep front and center as you're going on this journey, right? And it's really getting sucked into the vortex of life, right? And the things that really matter to you. It's the same across a long period of time. So that was really influential, yeah.
I haven't read either of those books. I'm surprised I haven't read Phil Knight's book. It's been recommended a few times. And I wasn't a huge Nike fan, but I love their app. It creates community, gets me out running. And so I've just bought into the whole sort of Nike cult's Nike tribe.
You'll be getting a tattoo after you read the book.
Oh, really? Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Is there a favorite tool or app that you think everyone should download?
Look, one I've been using recently is Brave, which is the browser, which basically blocks all third-party
cookies,
advertising, stop sucking your data. So when you understand how much we're the product of all the devices we use and you think you are in control and you realize how much you've been shaped, whether it be curated content, you know, obviously YouTube, like 70% of the videos that people watch is the up next, like they know what to put in front of you. So I guess I wanted to not have to dig into willpower and remove that as a temptation. So 90% of the time now I'm using Brave to remove all the ads, all the targeted ads off, you know, 10 plus years of data that Google have got on me. It's distracting. So if you want to do deep work and constantly getting distracted and stop that residue moving from one thing to another and going off in a little thought bubble, which is not that hard for me. I'm like a Labrador. Likewise. I can get distracted quite easily. So I'm like, all right, well, what's the one thing that's going to change this rather than just fighting with discipline? I'm like, okay, I need to start using Brave. So Brave's one, and I think Spotify.
Oh, Spotify's the best.
Like, what else can you do in life day to day that will shift your mood faster than anything other than music? Like, taking to a place, if you're feeling down and you want to feel better, like music. Like everyone should have music. I don't know, when I walk into places, there's no music playing. I'm like, how do you guys operate like this? It can literally just does something magical to your body. There's a really good book called Your Brain on Music. And it's a guy who wrote it who was a DJ and music producer, but also a neuroscientist now. And goes through the history, but you know what music does to your brain and your body is just quite phenomenal. So everyone needs Spotify as well.
Totally. I've actually got emotional playlists. Like when I want to feel happy or motivated or I want to chill and focus, I've got those ones all sorted. Actually, it's really nice for you to say that you won't use your willpower, because I look at you, Matt, and go, oh, this guy is so disciplined.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're using a system to help you out is like reassuring for the mortals that are listening to, including myself. So what is a song that gets you fired up in terms of, that we talked about music?
Yeah, look, there's one song, it's called Happiest Man Alive. And his name is Michael Montano. He's a soca singer from the Caribbean. So the backstory is my wife is from Trinidad and Tobago. Soca is huge over there. And this song's called Happiest Man Alive. So I thought I'd give you a song that most people probably wouldn't have heard, but jump on it. It's upbeat. It's feel good. It's got some good lyrics and it's got some ties from where my wife came from. So extra points there.
Amazing. Well, that's my happy playlist. Fantastic. Yeah. And a favorite quote that you live by?
Someone once said to me when I was about 14, if it is to be, it's up to me. And anytime you're feeling down or really getting that victim mentality or trying to blame, just saying that, well, if it is to be, it's up to me. It's just refocuses me fast and gets focused on, well, what am I going to do about this, rather than blaming external factors for that. Which sort of feeds me another quote, which I think is great, which is basically, I'm the sky and everything is the weather.
Oh, love that.
Yeah. That came out of, which book did that came out of? That came out of Neurodharma by Rick Hansen. If everyone wants to read that, 7 Steps to High Happiness. But yeah, I actually when I think about that quote, it just creates a real visual for me.
Same.
Yeah. So the combination of those two, that on the sky, everything's the weather. And then if it is to be, it's up to me. I think are really helpful for myself.
Combo.
Yeah.
Definitely about the sky. I was talking about the balcony before, but I'm trying to break my association with work meeting in front of a screen.
Yes.
So I actually get the best ideas when I'm outside.
Mm.
So I've just got to incorporate walking and being out in, like, we've got great Australian weather,
yes,
just getting outside and incorporating that in. And something about the sky, it's like the possibilities are unreal.
Yes.
Matt, if people are listening, feeling inspired by this conversation, where can they reach you?
So they can go to website, matthewstewart.co. You can go to Instagram, Matt J. Stewart. You can find my handle there. LinkedIn, they're the main ones. And soon to be released podcast as well. So, yeah,
stay tuned. I can't wait for your podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about it just before we hit record and sounds like you've got incredible interviews. And
yes,
I think just everything you've shared here could be its own podcast episode in terms of the pragmatic ideas, but ways of thinking about how we live this one life. And you talk about the book of life as well. So look forward to listening to that and adding more pages to my book. Matt, thank you so much for visiting, for coming to the podcast studio in Brisbane. And I always love our conversations and getting ideas from you.
And likewise, look, you're very inspirational in the journey that you've taken. And I think everyone will know, like, leaving your job and going out there and putting yourself out there does take a lot of courage. And for those who don't know Leanne personally, yes, she does always smile and she's okay most of the time. But, you know, underneath it, it does take a lot of courage. So thanks for inspiring others and for practicing what you preach.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much.
You're the best. Thank you so much for tuning in to Work and Live Large. I really appreciate you. If you know someone in your network and you think, oh my gosh, they've got so much potential, like, I want them to live and work larger, send them this episode. I think they might appreciate it. I also appreciate hearing from you, your feedback, your thoughts, your questions, anything. You can shoot me an email, hello@leannehughes.com, or find me on LinkedIn, just search for Leanne Hughes. Stay up to date with all the episodes by heading on over to leannehughes.com/subscribe, and all the best with your week as you go around living it up.